Accession number 12910, Reel 5.
Mr. Imre Reel 5.
Thank you. Well, we were talking about Jabotinsky, and I think you would be right qualifying Zionism. He was a Zionist in a hurry. And we used to call the extreme Zionists revisionists. It's been said of Jabotinsky that he was a gentleman. He was very highly thought of poet, and it's believed of Jabotinsky that he wouldn't stoop to a cowardly murder. But he did want Palestine as a home for the Jews, and he wanted it urgently. He didn't want any waiting. He was an extremist from that point of view. He had a long, fairly checkered career. He was responsible in World War One, together with the one-armed Russian Tsarist officer, Trumpeldor. He was responsible for organizing a Jewish unit to fight alongside the British in Gallipoli. Then came the end of the war, and all that Jabotinsky wanted was for the Balfour Declaration to be put into practical operation just as quickly as ever it could be. And from that point of view, he was regarded by the British with extreme suspicion, because they never knew where he was, what he was up to, and they wanted to know. But their intelligence, certainly on Jabotinsky, was extremely poor, and they never really caught up with him much. In point of fact, he was, I believe, much of the time, when he wasn't traveling. Of course, he was a great traveler in the United States, in Europe, all over, lobbying for Zionism. But much of the time, when he was in Jerusalem, he was sitting comfortably in the Fast Hotel in Jerusalem, in the middle of everything. And the British didn't seem to know it. And I know about this because I was on friendly terms with a certain special branch constable. And I remember on one occasion chatting with him, and he said, "I've been patrolling round trying to find if Jabotinsky is here." He said, they don't seem to know anything about him in headquarters, and they hadn't even provided me with a photograph. He said, "I don't know what I'm looking for." Well, this seemed to me pretty extraordinary. Anyway, time went on, and I had a Jewish acquaintance in Jerusalem. I had met him originally in the fairly famous bookshop called Popper's Bookshop in the middle of Jerusalem. And I used to see this chap occasionally. I don't know what his name was. I don't know who he was at all. The only thing I do remember about him was we used to talk books, and a book had just been published by Winston Churchill called Marlborough, His Life and Times. And this particular individual, whoever he was interested in this book. I had just bought it, and he was very interested, and we used to discuss it. I think that was volume one of that particular book, publication. Anyway, we were sitting on one occasion chatting in the Vienna Cafe in the middle of Jerusalem, and in walked somebody, and he came up to the table and talked to my acquaintance. He was wearing dark glasses, I suppose medium height, perhaps, nondescript looking man, and carrying a briefcase, a big black briefcase, and he was introduced perfunctorily to me as Dr. Zev, Z-E acute E-V, Anyway, in due course, they talked in Hebrew, I suppose. I presume it was Hebrew. In due course, he got up and went. And that was it. Several weeks later, or a little while later, I was chatting with my acquaintance, book acquaintance again, and he said, you know, we met Dr. Zev not very long ago. He said, you know who he was? He said, that was Vladimir Jabotinsky. So I have had a nodding acquaintance with Jabotinsky.
When would that have been, do you think?
I should think that was probably, again, fairly far on in 34. I don't know. So those are those two. I think I've got two more Palestine reminiscences. They both occurred in Jerusalem. The first one I always regard as the best piece of police work I ever did. It was at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and every year there is a ceremony called the Ceremony of the Holy Fire. This means that in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where there are a number of chapels given over to various denominations, they all assemble in these chapels at a given time on a certain date every year. In the rotunda, somewhere concealed below the tomb, I believe, the tomb, alleged tomb of Jesus, there is a priest. And at a certain time, through certain apertures in this cave, lighted tapers appear. They're pushed out by the priests. And at that juncture, everybody gets terribly excited, and they all try to press forward and bathe their hands in these tapers, or to light their own tapers and to bathe their faces and their hands in this holy fire. This is called the Ceremony of the Holy Fire. It frequently results in trouble, factional trouble between the people in the various chapels. And even serious riots have occurred. On one occasion, I was assigned this task, and I was given the task of looking after maybe 200 people in one of these chapels. One of these little aisle chapels. And trouble did break out. And I managed to keep my particular flock in perfect order. I managed to talk to them in semi-French, semi-Arabic, by signs, semi-English, and somehow I managed to keep them from the awful chaos and semi-carnage that occurred all around us, with everybody getting terribly excited and hit up. And at the end of it, mine was the only responsibility that wasn't involved in this general jamboree that went on inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And somebody came along to me a little while later, presented me with a little wooden figure. He said, well, thank you for what you did for us. And I regard that as the best piece of police work I ever did. That's, then there's one more reminiscence, which I have, I think. I have, in point of fact, I have two more, but I will speak about this particular one. It was a very devious sort of affair. There had been a burglar in Jerusalem. And he'd always gone for, he'd broken into houses belonging to rich Jews and Europeans of the upper echelon. And he always went for objet d'art, things that would fetch a good price, a good sale price. And nobody knew who he was. Nobody could catch him. House after house was broken into. I, at that time, was at police headquarters, and the IG, Inspector General, had just started a system of modus operandi. Briefly, the system of modus operandi depends on the mind of a burglar. If a burglar has been successful in doing a job, the likelihood is that knowing his stuff, knowing the ins and outs of the way he did it, he will do it again exactly the same way. Modus operandi, method of working. So if you have a card index of your known criminals, it is possible that you can narrow down the field of inquiry quite considerably. Roy Spicer, the Inspector General, considered that it would work, and he was determined that it should work if possible, if it would work in Palestine. Some of his senior officers were very sceptical about this. They didn't think it would work in a place where opportunism really prevailed. Spicer was determined to do it, and I was selected, sat down in an office, and I was told to collate all the information possible on index cards in order to form a modus operandi system, which I proceeded to do. There was an Arab assistant superintendent called Abdeen Bey, who had at one time been a bandit in the Caucasus. He'd worked under the Turkish regime for quite a while, and then he became a policeman under the British. He was a tremendous character. He knew everything that was going on, an awful lot of things that were going on, and he was getting a great deal of stick over this burglar. He was being pressed from on high. Indeed, the High Commissioner was pressing the Inspector General. And this pressure came all the way down the line. And Abdeen Bey, who was in charge of operations, was having a difficult time. He used to come to my modus operandi bureau and ask me questions. How did it work? Could we narrow down the criminals in any degree at all? Eventually, we did narrow down the possibilities. And then I didn't hear any more for a bit. And then Abdeen called me and a pal of mine, whose name is Bill Galvin, who was a constable. He called us into his office one day and he said, "I want your help." He said, "You see, I now know who this burglar is." He said, "I don't need to tell you how and why I know who he is, but his name is El Masri, which means the Egyptian." And he said, "I can tell you a little about him." He said, "If we were under the Turkish regime," he said, "it would be quite easy, because all we would do would be to plant some stolen property on El Masri, and then we would arrest him, and he would go to prison for a long time." But he said, "We can't do that now." He said, "Mr. Spicer, if he knew, would be extremely angry, and I would get the sack." He said, "What I'm now going to do," he said, "with your help, because I want you," he said, "is we shall only need to be just a little Turkish." And he said, "What we will do," he said, "I am able to get a message to El Masri without him knowing that it comes from me." He said, "You are both friends of a man, and I shall call him Mr. Brown, who was a wealthy European, a wealthy Englishman living in Jerusalem with a very nice house. He was a bachelor. And he had a lot of, he paid a lot of money in buying some very nice things. And he said, Mr. Brown has in his house a lot of the things that El Masri would like. We shall arrange, you will go to Mr. Brown and you will ask him if he will permit his house to be burgled by El Masri. And when El Masri comes along, we shall be there." Anyway, we saw our friend Brown, and he entered into the whole thing with tremendous zest and spirit. A month or 6 weeks went by, during which Abdeen got various messages to El Masri and said, "It's too dangerous. for Elmasrie to Burgle, Mr. Brown's house. It's just not on. Anyway, at last, a message was sent to him that Brown was going to be away in Jaffa. And anyway, that was the night it was hoped that Elmasrie would burgle Brown's house. Anyway, there were various preliminaries, and we, various of us, including Galvin and myself, Abdeen Bay, and two more British constables, we got separately and on our own at about 6 o'clock in the evening into Brown's house, where we arranged ourselves along the passageway where it was hoped, according to the modus operandi, that Elmasrie might break in. We stayed there until about 3 o'clock in the morning, very quietly. We hardly moved all that time. And I was getting thoroughly fed up with all this. And anyway, finally, when I was just about wondering what on earth was going to happen, when suddenly there was a crash on the window, one of the windows around this balcony, this veranda, and there was a tinkle of breaking glass, and something fell on the floor. Then, about 3 or 4 minutes later, a pinpoint of light, which in fact was Abdeen's torch, pinpoint torch. And there was a sort of slithering noise. And I thought, my God, is Elmasrie in the house, or what's happening? What is happening? It was a terrifying moment. And then suddenly all the lights went on, and Abdeen was in fits and guffaws of laughter. He said, out-turk, the bastards out-turked us. In fact, the tinkle of glass was a stone with a message attached to it, message around it, thrown through the glass of the veranda. And it was in Arabic, and it was addressed to Abdeen from Elmasrie, who was apologising for keeping us waiting for such an awful long time. He said, I've just finished a job on the house next door. He said, I had observed you all going into the house, into Mr. Brown's house. I had somehow wondered about Mr. Brown being away. Now I know that Mr. Brown wasn't away. However, I did manage, thank Mr. Brown very much. I have managed to take his very nice carpet off the ground floor. He said, but it was too dangerous for me to stay, so I've just finished burgling the house next door. And he said, I am so sorry to keep you waiting all this long time. And Abdeen turned to Brown, and he said, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Brown, but you have been burgled. And anyway, the two of them became fast friends, and they were always in the Vienna Cafe together, and we used to join them. But a sequel to this was, Spicer, of course, had been bully-ragging at Abdeen all the time, not catching the burglar. But then Abdeen was called into Spicer's office, into the IG's office one day, and he didn't know what on earth it was about, and he was worrying. And anyway, he went in there, and he stood there, completely nonplussed, and Spicer looked at him, and he said, I must congratulate you, Abdeen. He said, I've told them to give you a high commendation. He said, you've got rid of this burglar. He said, he's left Jerusalem. He said, he's written to me. And he said that it's entirely due to the vigilance of your officer, Abdeen Bey, who has made life too difficult for me to stay in Jerusalem. He said, I'm now going down to Cairo. He said, well, the pickings look like they'd be quite good. So that was that.
Can I ask you a question about Jewish-Arab relations in Palestine? What are your general comments about them from your own observation relating to the 32-35 period?
Well, of course, they were daggers drawn all the time. I knew very, very few Jews, personally. Those I did meet were cultured people. I really have very little comment about it. The only comment I think I can usefully make is that Haji Amin al-Husseini wielded total power, almost covering the whole of my period in Palestine, and from then on. If any Arab went counter to any edicts thrown out by Haji Amin, he was liable to be assassinated by Haji Amin's hit gangs. And I think it likely, although I can't say for sure, that this would have extended to any sort of fraternization of any kind with Jews. The only exception to that that I would make would be within the police force. You see, at that time, there were two sections in the police force. There was the British section, numbering about 850, and there was the Palestinian section, numbering a bit over 2,000. And the Palestinian section was the name given to the band of men who comprised both Arabs and Jews. So the term, the connotation Palestinian in those days, meant Arabs and Jews.
Did you have any particular feelings one way or the other towards the Arab or the Jewish case?
One couldn't help it. One, almost to a man, I think, people, certainly in the police force, they were pro-Arab. There were a few who weren't. There were a few who served in Jewish Arab areas who found contentment in serving there and mixing with Jews. But I think I can say with certainty that right from Whitehall downwards, there was a pro-Arab bias. And I think this went right down the line. I think it's a sort of thing that nobody in Whitehall would countenance for one moment, anything of that sort. Because, I mean, there were all sorts of things. There was the Balfour Declaration. There were some people at absolutely the top echelon who were totally and utterly in favour of the Jewish national home. But certainly, among the rank and file in the police, I think we were what you might call crudely pro-Arab to a man.
Why was it?
Because this was the policy which was pushed down from Whitehall. I think it came down all along the line. You see, you had a number of Orientalists, well-known Orientalists around at that time. There was Stuart Perrone, who wrote a number of books and was for a time married to Freya Stark. He was, he became an Arabist, pure and simple. There were people like Peek Pasha, who ran the Arab Legion with Glob. Arabists, complete Arabists. A man whose name I can't remember. He was an archaeologist, a total Arabist, and that went, I think, all along the right down the line.
Yes, it didn't stop you and that ex black and tan feeling sympathy for the Jewish refugees arriving on.
Well,
that
no. You see, it was a pathetic arrival. That women and children, and an absolute ecstasy at touching Israeli shore. I wonder very often how many men, apart from Eric, would have done that. But underneath that that craggy exterior and with his a pretty rough background, I mean, there was a remarkable sympathy, which, and I felt much the same. I mean, Alec would have got the sack straight away, if anybody had known. But I wasn't saying a word.
How did you come to leave Palestine in 35?
We had all known of the existence of something called the List, L-I-S-T, which existed in police headquarters. This was a list of young men in the British section who were considered by the Inspector General to be potential officer material for the Colonial Police Service. And the Inspector General, that's Roy Spicer, had already sounded the Colonial Office, and I believe it right to say that he'd been told that he might have, for his young men in Palestine, he might have X percentage of the vacancies in other colonies that occurred. So there was this list, and inevitably there were leakages, and one knew in due course that one's name was on this list. And so it was simply a question of awaiting one's turn and keeping within the right lines before something would happen. And eventually I was offered a cadetship, officer cadetship in the Gold Coast Police, and I accepted, and away I went.